Why do we cry? How come love hurts? And what's a happiness researcher doing talking about sadness anyway? My name's Helen Russell. I'm an author, journalist, and happiness researcher. And How to Be Sad is a podcast based on my book of the same name, exploring why we get sad, what to do when we're sad, and how we can all get happier by learning to be sad better. In this podcast, I'll be talking to people from all walks of life, and each episode I'll be joined by a special guest sharing their own story. Welcome to How to Be Sad. My guest today is the toy designer Matthew Ashton, Vice President of Design at LEGO, Executive Producer on the LEGO Movies, Creator of Unikitty, and Head Judge on LEGO Masters UK. Most recently, he's also the man behind LEGO's first ever LGBTQ+ set, the rainbow-inspired Everyone is Awesome. The set represents a huge milestone both for LEGO and for Matthew personally, who's spoken out about the struggles he faced growing up as an LGBTQ+ kid in the 1980s and 90s. He says, "Being told what I should play with, how I should walk, how I should talk, what I should wear, the message I always got was that somehow I was wrong. I wish as a kid I had looked at the world and thought, this is going to be okay, there's a place for me. I wish I'd seen an inclusive statement that said everyone is awesome." And so now he's made it himself. He's putting it out there into the world to mark the start of Pride Month. Matthew Ashton, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. All getting a bit emotional before we've even started.
It's lovely to have you here. But you've talked about being told what to play with when you were little and what to be doing and feeling like there wasn't a place for you. Were there toys that you were discouraged from playing?
Yes. And I think in that way, I did, like, there was a lot of, I was quite an effeminate kid and generally gravitated towards things that were more of the girly kind of products and TV shows and everything that were around at the time. I did love stuff like Star Wars and Transformers. From a Star Wars perspective, it was always sort of Princess Leia that I gravitated towards, and the droids and kind of all the campness, rather than the actual battling and things like that. So there was a lot of boys' stuff that I really liked, but I was also obsessed with cute animals, rainbow coloured things. So there was stuff like My Little Pony and Strawberry Shortcake and everything that I would have loved to have had myself, was dissuaded from having. I think ponies in particular, my mum was like, what are those things anyway? I'm not paying for that. What are you going to play with that? But yes, so I desperately wanted a few things like that in my life and wasn't allowed them. Luckily, I had a sister who was. But I think there was probably a bit of a sense of, from my parents, to try and keep me on the more boyish side of things. I think it was more of a fear that I may be bullied at school or something if I was turning up with girls' toys to school or whatever. So I think there was a real sort of sense that they were doing it for the right thing. But in all honesty, I probably think seeing half-naked He-Man running around in a cartoon, holding aloft his magic sword at a whim, probably had more of an impact on my sexuality than brushing a pony's hair would have done. So, and in all honesty, neither of those things would have had an impact on where I was heading. But yes, so there was, I think, a sense of people trying to protect me more in the hope that it would stop me being bullied, I think, than anything else. So, yep.
And tell me about school. Was there bullying?
There was obviously a little bit of teasing, like with as there is with all kids. But I actually think the one thing that I struggled with as a child more was a lot of the stuff that adults were saying around me rather than what kids were saying. And I think some of that came from a good intention of trying to protect me, others not so much. And so there was a sort of sense that I was a bit of a sissy, liked playing girly stuff, liked hanging out with girls more. I was always being told, oh, you throw like a girl, you run like a girl, and all of that kind of stuff, which I really, really, as a kid, did not understand, because most of my friends were girls and I didn't see what the problem was, and I thought girls were awesome. And so to be being called that in a negative way, I was like, is there something wrong with me? And the fact that it was so many adults around me that were probably just saying throwaway comments now and again really started sort of chipping away at who I was, making me doubt, like, is there something wrong with me? Why are so many people in my life telling me that I should be a certain way that I wasn't? And that became sort of quite exhausting in a way, because every aspect of what came naturally to me, like the way I gesticulated, the way I talked and everything, I kind of felt I needed to sort of rein that in, and that became really, really exhausting and hard work, to be honest. So yeah.
And when you're a little kid and you are trying to, if you're trying to hide a big part of yourself, mm. and as you say, it's exhausting, how does that manifest? Are you tired all the time?
I think generally up till 10, I think I apart from the don't play with this, do that, it was fine. It was more when I started secondary school, I think that's where it became a bit more of a problem. I'd always had a lot of girlfriends at primary school. And then my first year of secondary school, I actually went to an all boys school. So then I felt like I didn't really have that safety net of my girlfriends around me then. And that felt sort of really intimidating in a way. It really, to me, sort of highlighted how different I was to a lot of the other boys and things, which was a bit of a struggle.
This is a time of Section 28, so there's no discussion of any kind of LGBTQ.
No, not at all. So that had sort of come into play around that time. And so there was just nothing being discussed about LGBTQ things at school at all. And then as well, it was also around the period where there was the AIDS crisis happening, which of course, as a little kid, I didn't know really what was going on. I knew it was gay men that were catching it and that were dying it. Even in schools, there was a lot of, it became a bit of a sort of slur or a teasing thing in a way that people would be like, you've got AIDS to each other. And it would just become a thing that was just a little bit nasty. And so I knew that was kind of going on. So there was a lot of stuff that was going on around me that was sort of painting such a negative perception of gay people, or I just wasn't being told anything about it that was making it sort of difficult to navigate as well.
You're right. I remember that, you know, the TV ads and the leaflets through the doors, there was a lot of coverage at
yes.
that time.
Yep. Yeah.
And at that stage, when you were starting secondary school, were you kind of clear that, you know, yeah, I am gay?
I knew I was different. So right the way from when I was a little kid, I knew I was different to a lot of the boys. Didn't really understand why. Of course, it's not until the hormones start kicking in, and the same for anybody when they realise they're starting to be attracted to people and things. So it kind of shifted from me flicking through the Gretton catalogue for my Christmas wish list to be like, ooh, men in pants. That's a new thing.
That's so, buying a lot of pants.
Exactly. So it's kind of like when things like that start happening, and then I kind of started to realize where things may be headed, but I was in complete denial about it at the same time, because I think growing up in the 80s, you had this sort of, well, for a start, there wasn't much representation anywhere of any or many gay people. So even pop stars that have subsequently come out as gay afterwards, like George Michael and Elton John and everything, that was not really the thing that I was aware of back then. And I think there was such a picture perfect vision of everybody should get married, have 2.4 children. And I kind of also wanted that myself, thought I could quite easily live with a girl, not really understanding exactly how babies were made and things at that point. So I kind of always thought to myself that was the end goal, and I had to get there, whatever the case. And because of that, no matter what I was sort of feeling inside, I kind of kept trying to sort of quash that and make sure it didn't become a thing. And then the more I was thinking about stuff like that, the more it sort of became, right, if something happens, I may kiss a boy or whatever once, get it out of my system, realize that's not what I want, and then get back on track and do the whole marriage and kids and everything that I'm supposed to do in life thing. And yep.
Then
didn't really
happens?
Go that way. Yes. Kissed a boy and I liked it. So, and going back to the Section 28 thing as well, it was not being told much stuff around anything to do with LGBTQ, and me also feeling like I was the only kid in the school that was like that. I did not know until I was around sort of 16, when I ultimately met the first boyfriend. Yes, it just felt like I was the only kid in the entire school that was sort of going through what I was going through. Of course, now I'm older. Everybody else has come out. We're like, oh my God, you were too. It's very different now. Yes, it was tricky.
So where
it was
did you
tricky.
Learn? Like, what, you know, sex ed classes weren't...
Yes, and to be honest, no, and I did have, I do remember, this was around when I was 16, we were having a sex ed class, and of course it was all what straight people do and how babies are made and all of that kind of things we were shown.
Barely, back in the day, barely.
Exactly. Yes, it was some 1970s video where everybody looked like they backcombed their nether regions. I don't think anybody was like, oh, we want to go do this now. So I think during that class, it was kind of, yes, it was super, super awkward. And the thing that made it even worse is... obviously, me being a bit effeminate and probably the one that stood out in the class, the teacher at that point sort of said, looking me dead straight in the eye, was like, oh, and apparently 1 in 10 people are gay, so that means there's 3 of you in this room. And I was just mortified that he was sort of bringing attention to me when I was doing my absolute best to hide it. I was actually dating my boyfriend at the time, who was sat next to me, that was not as obviously gay as I was. And everything was sort of top secret between us. It was only us that knew what was going on, and we were sort of having to scuttle around and keep everything a secret and things. But then it was, that was sort of quite intimidating in a way. But at the same time, me and my boyfriend were like, oh my God, who's the other one? So, yes. Yes. So, but I also want to say that, and kudos to my mum as well, when I was about 10 years old, I had this incident at school where one of the girls in my class came up to me and she was like, Matthew, do you know what a condom is? So I'd overheard some bigger boys talking about condoms, and so I told her what it was and didn't get it quite right. So I
did
knew...
you tell her?
Well, I knew it was a balloon that you put on your willy. I, for some reason, had imagined, I don't know why, it was a blown-up balloon that you tied to your willy.
Nice. Be
had
jolly.
No idea why you do that. So that kind of got back to her mum, that got back to my mum, and my mum decided, right, now is probably the time that we need to tell Matthew how things work and stuff. So she gave me the birds and the bees talk. But after she'd explained everything, she also... said to me, and sometimes men fall in love with other men, they may do some stuff together, women may fall in love with other women, and that's a thing too. Not going into any sort of detail and stuff, but I just was like, looking back now, I think there are, I don't know how many parents would have had those conversations with their kids at 10 years older, right in the middle of the 80s. So I think that was super lovely that she obviously sensed that this was where, oh sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional, sensed a little bit where this may be headed for me, and she did sort of let me know that that was a thing as well. So yep,
you lost a mummy, Ashley.
I know. Bless her.
And then, so when you're 16 and you have your first boyfriend, have you had the next conversation with your mum at this stage?
Not to begin with. And I think even though I'd had that conversation at 10, it's kind of like coming out is such a huge hurdle, or at least was back then. I know for some people it's not as big a deal now, but there's also so many people that have to go through the difficulty of coming out. And it's kind of when you, well, for me at least, I can only speak from my own experience, for when you've kind of spent a lot of your life feeling like, you know, you may be letting people down, you may be embarrassing people, you may, you know, you may not be what they expected you to be. It's such a mental leap to then actually admit it to yourself, like me and my boyfriend could not even say the word gay about ourselves or to each other. It was kind of like, we're in love. The G word just could not come from either our lips, because there was so much negativity around that. And it's kind of the first time we kissed as well. It was just like, even though it was amazing, it was also the most terrifying thing as well, because then you kind of realize, oh, this is it, and this is the way that I am and I'm going to be. And it was sort of confirmation of all of that, which was, at least for me, a lot to sort of take. And through my teenage years as well, I'd had a lot of problems with my emotions in general. Is if I either was feeling really anxious about something or got really upset about something, it used to make me sick. So I was vomiting, like, whenever something difficult was sort of going on around me. So to have all of that sort of built up inside you, to know that you need to tell your parents, but not knowing what that reaction is going to be. You don't know whether, deep down, I knew that it would probably be all right, but, you know, you don't know, like, what kind of disappointment or things that you're going to cause them. So it was really, really tough getting to that point where it was like, right, I need to say something. So there's just one morning I'd been sick and I was in such a mess that I just went into my mum's room in the morning, floods of tears, and was like, Mum, I've got something to tell you. I'm in love with somebody and it's a boy. And sorry, this is all coming back to me now. And of course, she reacted in the best way that she possibly could, like gave me a big hug and was like, everything's going to be all right. Of course, she was concerned whether this was just a phase, whether it's what I really wanted. And of course, all the repercussions of what this could mean for my life afterwards. But she was really, really good about it. But at the same time, it was also one of the things that we also decided to keep between us for the time being. So I had somebody that I could talk to in her, but both of us sort of needed to figure out when we should tell other people, because obviously the broader family and all of that kind of things, because my dad come from a background that was, his parents were not the most politically correct of people. In fact, I remember when I was really young, I was round at my grandma's house on my dad's side, and a gay person had come on TV and she'd sort of said, oh, they're disgusting. We need to stick them all on a desert island and blow the lot of them up and things as well. So knowing that I've sort of have elements of that within my family also makes it even more difficult, because no matter what I would have had to deal with, I wouldn't want my parents falling out with my grandma over this and the whole family sort of turning into disarray. So I kind of had that sort of weight on my shoulders as well.
That's such a large mental load.
Yep.
And when you were growing up and feeling this anxiety and then it manifest in being sick, did anybody ever sort of pick up on that? Was it accepted that it was a...
No, and I kind of kept it like really, really quiet. It wasn't like an eating disorder or anything, but I was also painfully thin as a teenager and things as well. So I think my parents were just like doing their best to keep me fed and whatever. So I don't, it was something that I knew it was about to happen, run to the bathroom, wipe the tears away, come back, and life would just sort of carry on. So...
And was there a stage that stopped?
Yeah, so I think it was mainly through my teenage years. I think once I kind of got to university, I went to university in Brighton, which of course was at that point one of the most LGBTQ friendly cities in the country. And the fact that when I started uni, I felt like I could put any of the sort of difficult parts of my life behind me. It was a fresh new start. It was a fresh group of people. And that was the first time that I ever felt like I could, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, but like even breathe properly.
And tell me about when you were able to tell your dad.
I hadn't really, really spoken to him about it until the day he drove me down to university. And of course, I started this conversation quite early on in the journey. And it was a very long journey driving from the Wirral to Brighton. So,
hours are we talking
yes, here? But honestly, it was one of the most lovely conversations that I've ever had with my dad, and he got quite emotional, which I hadn't necessarily seen my dad be like that much throughout my life. And he just wanted the best for me, wanted me to be safe and happy. But I think the thing that he was struggling with the most was that he thought that I would potentially be a really good dad. And at that point, that didn't seem like it would be an option. And he was just so worried that I'd sort of be missing out of something in my life, like having kids. And so that was pretty much his biggest concern. So yeah, so it was actually a really, really lovely conversation. Dropped me off at uni in the most revolting halls of residence. And he's like, oh my God, I can't leave you here. Come back with us. And I was like, no, Dad, I need to stay. This is a thing now. So yeah, so he dropped me off. And yeah, so that was actually really, really special that I got that chance to have such an in-depth conversation with him about it. So, yep.
Isn't that interesting? Side-by-side conversations. Yes. Psychologists always say that exactly. They are really good walking or in cars for having those sort of chats.
No, I don't think I could have been looking him in the eye while we were having any of this conversation. So, yes, but it was really special.
It's obviously very emotional because you're kind of being your true self with your dad, but also the kid thing and the children thing, I see, makes you quite emotional now. How
it
do you
does.
Feel about that?
I don't know. I did go through, like when I was much younger, I was like, oh, I really, really wanted to have kids and wanted to have a family. That hasn't happened. I'm actually at a point now where I know it's probably not going to happen. And I'm actually all right with that. So I've got so many lovely, lovely friends that have got kids around me. You've got niece as well, who hopefully once COVID is over and done with, I get to spend a little bit more time with her. I've got my godson and things, and it's just that I have got a lot of kids in my life that I can be the gunkle to and also hand them back when they get a little bit too much. So yes, and also the fact that I work for a toy company and my job is pretty much doing what I can to make kids happy around the world, and that kind of fulfills that sort of itch within me that I'm actually in a good place. And it may have been nice, but I also know it's not the case, and I'm actually fine with that.
And now tell us about your entry into the workplace.
Yes.
And how that came about.
Right, so obviously, I told you a little bit earlier about the dreams of being a toy designer when I was a kid. When I graduated, we had Graduate Fashion Week in London where we did our runway collections. And then after that, we had an exhibition in Islington Design Centre where it's called New Designers, where you sort of can display a selection of your work for sort of industry headhunters and things to have a mooch through. So, and you get a really, really limited space to put your work up, and there's only a select number of students from each university can do it. So most fashion designers hang up one garment and have their portfolio there or a mood board or something. I couldn't really decide what I wanted to do. So I created a miniature version of my catwalk collection on Barbie dolls and had them in a Perspex case as my display. Luckily, my exhibition area was right next to the exit, and which may sound like a bad thing, but it actually turned out to be a good thing. So at this exhibition, there was like fashion designers, photographers, illustrators, industrial designers, product designers. So there was a whole mix of sort of all of the creatives that had graduated that year were sort of displaying their work in this one business center. So there was actually some Lego headhunters that had gone to meet some of the product and industrial designers, happened on the way to be leaving the building to get their lunch, walked past my stand, saw the Barbie dolls, also dug a little bit through my portfolio and saw that I'd done some like really cute kids wear and stuff as well. And then ultimately left their business card with somebody on the stand and said, get Matthew to get in touch. Luckily, they were around later. I had a little chat with them, managed to do a little bit of freelance work for them that then cascaded into a little bit more. I was juggling several jobs at the same time to sort of keep some steady income going. So I was doing textile design and working in a supermarket. And so juggling all of that was a bit of a nightmare. So a year later, I just phoned Lego and I was like, look, I've done some work for you now. Hope you're happy with it. I would really like a permanent job. I can't really keep going on this freelance gig for much longer. So if you would like me, let me know. And they were like, oh my gosh, yes, we need you. Like, start next week. So literally, I packed my bags and moved over to Denmark instantly. So, yes.
Now, it's not Copenhagen, is it? It's not the fun bit. Where in Denmark did you move to, Matthew?
I moved to a little place called Billund. When I flew over here for my interview, I presumed I was staying in a hotel on the outskirts of town. And I was like, oh, this is just the edge of it. There must be a bigger city here.
Buzzing hub
of excitement. So I accepted the job, came back and was like, oh, that is it. That is the town. So, and of course, Billund has developed a lot since I started. I've been here 21 years now, but it was cows and fields and the smells that come with that, with some Lego buildings plopped in the middle of it, next to a fairly small airport at that time as well. So, yeah.
I'd like to share that there's still a lot of cows and people and the smells that go with them.
Exactly. The thing was, on the first day, though, it was like such a baptism of fire because the day I arrived was the day that all of the creatives were being gathered together for this big sort of team building creative workshop that I was supposed to be part of. And I went up to the conference room, so there must have been probably about 60, 70 designers or something in there. We were all told to sort of stand in a circle and then there was going to be an introductory icebreaker. So I was stood next to the head of design at that point who just hired me, and he was like, right, and he's just really charismatic, vivacious, like bundle of energy, stood next to me. And he's like, right, this workshop's called Blue Samba. Don't know exactly why. But then he was like, so what we're going to do is go around in a circle and introduce ourselves by either singing a little song, doing a little dance routine, pretending to be a musical instrument. And I was like, oh my God, what have I signed up? So he did his. I was expecting him to go the other way around the circle and end with me last. But he was like, nope. Now, Matthew, you introduce yourself to 70 people I'd never met in my life after he'd done some very elaborate salsa situation. And I was just so mortified and so embarrassed that I was like, oh, if I was going to describe myself as a musical instrument, I'd probably be a triangle. Ding! Just because I just wanted it to be over and done with as soon as possible.
Yes, so we're British,
I was just exactly.
So
move on. So that was my introduction to Lego. The really good thing about that, though, is there'd been another couple of internationals start within the last month, and there was this girl there called Kat who was like, oh my God, new gay best friend, and just latched onto me instantly after that, and we've been amazing friends ever since. So that worked out for the best.
So there has been, you have had a long and illustrious career at Lego, so 21 years now.
Yes.
But it has not always been without its difficulties, has it?
No. So generally, and honestly, it has been the best experience of my life in many ways. I've had so many opportunities. I never imagined I'd be in a company for 21 years. It's something that every time where I'd sort of got itchy feet and was like, oh, maybe I should do or try something else, then another super, super exciting project came along and things. And it's just in many ways been amazing. But at the same time, working for any big company, yes, there were days where I'm like, oh, I need to pinch myself. I can't believe I'm working at Lego and everything. And then other days, it can be very much like working for any other big corporation that there is red tape and bureaucracy and office politics and all of that, that kind of can suck the fun out of some of your days at work, but generally amazing. But I did, round 2016, I was really struggling with a lot of things, both personally and at work. So I'd been working on the Lego movies, which had been such an amazing experience and is something that I'm super, super proud of. But the workload involved in that was just super, super intense. So,
and the travel as well.
Yes.
I felt you with the travel and the jet lag and the...
Yes. So, yeah, so the movies were... We're based in Denmark. Direction for the movies and the story writing was mainly happening in LA. For two of the movies, they were being produced and animated and everything in Sydney, the other one in Vancouver. So there was a lot of travel, which sounds like it's glamorous, but it's a lot of lost luggage, being stuck in airports with delayed flights, a lot of jet lag. And so that was going on. There was also a lot of really, really sort of late night calls where we were having to do 2 a.m. calls so LA and Sydney could be on a call at the same time. So, and that was kind of on top of my day job. So that was, I was overseeing 6 or 7 product lines at the same time as working on the movies. So that meant that I was kind of burning the candle at both ends. At the same time, my family were actually going through some sort of personal ordeals and things back home. My dad had unfortunately been diagnosed with Parkinson's, which was just such a blow to him. He'd worked so incredibly hard throughout his entire life, had sort of been amassing this collection of little Airfix models and things in his man cave to sort of work on his hobby when he'd like retired. And then of course, having Parkinson's and not having the dexterity and things to really do that, that had sort of shattered his little retirement dream and everything. So, and of course that's really tough for him to deal with. And then at the same time, my grandma, on my mum's side, she was struggling really, really badly with horrific Alzheimer's, which was just so awful to sort of be experiencing alongside her. And of course, me living in a foreign country, not being able to get home, very often was making that difficult. And at one point, things had got so bad with her that she'd sort of convinced herself that I was dead. And which...
Don't apologise, it's very upsetting.
No, so my mum phoned me from the nursing home that she was in at this point, and she's like, look, your nan is in a terrible state. She thinks that you've died. Can you just get on the phone and talk to her and let her know that everything's all right? So in doing that, that actually made the situation worse because she didn't believe it was really me on the phone. She thought it was an imposter that was trying to pretend to be me. And then she then didn't trust my mum because she thought my mum was trying to trick her and things as well. So this just kind of escalated into this awful situation where, and I know you're not supposed to have favourites, but my grandma was super, super special to me. So not being able to talk to somebody that you really, really love because you're really frightening them was the worst. So having all of that sort of going on at the same time, and then of course when work is difficult, when I'm living in a foreign country I love but has never 100% felt like home, I got to the point where I'm 40 and I was still single, and of course all of that was like, whether it was a little bit of a midlife crisis or whatever it was just everything was becoming so overwhelming. And I realized that I just pushed myself too much. And it wasn't necessarily even work pushing me. Yes, there was a lot of demands at work, but also me being me and wanting to prove myself and wanting to not be seen as somebody who fails or somebody who could be the sissy that I'd been told I had been. I'd kept fighting and kept pushing and just pushed things to the limit and then ultimately broke. So the following Monday, I just had to go into the office, sat down with my boss and my immediate colleagues and were like, look, this is the situation. I'm broken and I need some time off. And from that point onwards, Lego and my boss and everybody were completely amazing, gave me the time that I needed and the help and support that I needed. So they assigned me a sort of occupational psychologist who also had a background in clinical psychology to sort of help me through the period of sort of building me back up to being able to come back to work again. So I did have 3 months off work while we tried to sort all these things out.
And was that your first experience of therapy?
Yes. And that in itself, because like it's so funny in a way. And I think some of this stems from me being told what I was as a kid and a teenager has then put this drive inside me that I am never going to look like the sissy. I'm never going to look like the weak one, to the point where I'm like quite happy flinging myself out of an aeroplane, jumping off waterfalls and things to prove that I can do, you know, all of these things that anybody else can do. And I think I'd sort of done the same with my career as well. And the fact that I was going to get help and see a therapist was just like, at first I took this as, right, you've really messed up, you're a failure now. So that was something that I never really wanted to deal with. And I'd kind of sort of poo-pooed people in the past, like, oh, therapists, do you know what I mean? But then I know, but now I know why they're there, what you need them for. So, but to be honest, when I first started with her, I was so, like, I'd literally been in floods of tears, like, throughout the week. And every time I had a session with her, there was nothing. And I was like, who is this woman? What's she doing? And like, she hasn't even made me cry once. What's the matter with her? She's not doing her job properly and everything. So I kind of stupidly thought that, you know, I could then fix myself. So being unsatisfied with the little progress that I'd made within 3 weeks, which is ridiculous, I then checked myself into this wellness center and thought, I'm just going to fix myself in a week. I'm not sort of patient enough to be going through this process. So then I went to this place where there was a lot of sort of different sessions and massages and relaxation things and creative activities and exercise activities and stuff. So I had a massage on the very first day and the guy was like, oh my God, you're so tense. And then by the end of the week, I went back to the same masseuse and he was like, oh my God, what has happened to you? You are like 10 times more tense than when you started. And even in a place where I was supposed to be relaxing and supposed to be, I'd like overscheduled myself to try and do this emergency fix to my life that I'd actually turned my life into even more of a tizzy. In a place where it's supposed to be the opposite. So then after that, I went back to the therapist, tail between my legs, and let her do her process properly. And luckily that really, really helped me out. So.
And what was it like coming back to work? I think in Denmark, there is a generosity towards people taking stress leave and people are looked after quite well. But I'm always curious, when you re-enter the workplace after some time off,
yeah,
what is that like? On a timeout, rather.
Yes. So basically, from being in the depths of despair, and honestly, I was in a super, super dark place by the time I kind of cracked and was diagnosed with sort of long-term stress and depression. But during those 3 months that I was off, there was a couple of opportunities that sort of came my way. And they were both like once in a lifetime things. So I was like, I can't let these things sort of pass me by, because I'd kind of lost my mojo a bit. Was like, right, I've been at Lego. It must have been like around 17, 18, 18 years or something by that point. And so I was kind of like, oh, is Lego still the right thing for me? Even though they've been great, I was like, maybe it's just time for a change. So I had two opportunities that came up. So firstly, I was contacted by another toy company who happens to have made My Little Ponies. And they contacted me and were like, look, we've heard great things about you. We'd like to interview you and offer you a job. Of course, there's a lot of contractual stuff that I would have had to have gone through if they were to offer me that and they were aware of that. So for me, it was like such a reassurance that, you know, somebody from the outside could see that I was good at my job, wanted to find out more about me. So that kind of like gave me a little bit of my confidence back. And then at the same time, the discussions around the Lego Masters TV show was in the works. But then going into Lego Masters, I was kind of like, oh, this could either be the most stupid thing that I've ever done in my life, putting myself on TV when I'm in such a vulnerable situation, or it could be the thing that helps turn my life around. So luckily, it ended up being the latter. So
it's hard, though, isn't it? Because yes. I think, you know, all of the, I'm sure your psychologist would have said that it's not about the external validation. And you have to kind of do the work, as you found. You have to do the work yourself and deal with, I guess, a lot of the things that you had been struggling with growing up.
Yep.
So we're not saying that you have to get a TV show to be
No, okay. No. And that is the last... I'm not saying anybody who's dealing with depression, go and stick yourself on TV.
Yeah,
no, that is definitely not what I'm saying. And to be honest, the things that helped me turn my life around through Lego Masters, none of it was to do with really the actual being on TV or any kind of level of Z-list fame, whatever it was. It was more the fact that I kind of lost my way a little bit at Lego, felt that I'd lost my voice, but then being on the show and meeting the contestants was just so sort of overwhelmingly positive, just to see what the brand meant to them, what building with Lego was a huge part of their lives, how sort of inspired and creative it was making people feel. And that was kind of the thing that was like, this is why I do my job. Because sometimes you can get tied up in everything that's going on internally at Lego and not necessarily always see the impact that this is having on kids and consumers' lives in every day. And that was the first time in a long time that I'd had that sort of first-hand experience. And I know this sounds probably a little bit dramatic, but like that show really helped save my life because it just completely flipped a switch in me and really got things back on track as well. So
is it fair then to say that it's because of you were then reconnected with the reason and the purpose that doing your job meant for you in the first place? It's the meaning.
Yes.
It's the Aristotle idea of happiness, of finding a meaning in life.
Yes.
So you hadn't really, because you'd got to such a level, you weren't actually interacting with the kids like you had been when
you
were a kid.
Exactly,
yes. This made a difference for.
Yes, so, and I think that was it. And of course, the other thing as well, so that was the brilliant side of Lego Masters. There was the other side of Lego Masters that it didn't really hit me until I was in the build room for the first time with a group of cameras in front of me. And then, of course, some of the demons did resurface from my childhood and stuff. It was kind of, obviously, to make the show exciting, I needed to seem sort of like a face of authority on the show. So production really wanted that from me. I was also very conscious of what Lego would want me to be like on the show. I also had my mum jokingly be like, do you remember the neighbours are going to be watching this, so don't embarrass me. And then, of course, I then had all of the things from my childhood whirling around in my head of like, don't be too gay and don't do this and don't mince and don't whatever. So I was kind of like so caught up in myself and like how I thought I should be on TV that I then got too tied up in all of that and then did not come across as myself. I was a bit of a plank of wood in the first few episodes. But ultimately, I think it's ended up in an okay place. I have to watch it through my fingers. And now, of course, it's spawned an international version of the show and everything as well. So it's really gone on to different levels now. So
And now you've been at Lego for 21 years.
Yes.
And this new set coming out.
Yes.
To mark the start of Pride Month. What do you hope that the set will mean to people?
So the reason why I created it, I wanted to be the big kid that stood up for little kids who felt different and to be able to give them the sort of tools and inspiration to become everything that they could within their life. So that was kind of what I wanted to do. No, it all sounds a bit fluffy and hippy-dippy and things, but it was just like that then gave me a real purpose back to then sort of be like, right, this is what I need to do at Lego, and this Everyone Is Awesome set is the sort of first manifestation of me trying to do something, and luckily the company has been super, super supportive and has got on board with all of that.
Thank you so much. And then finally, I love to end by asking all my guests, knowing all that you know now, What advice would you give to your 21-year-old self about how to be sad?
Oh, I think probably take a bit of a chill pill, chill out. Don't worry too much about what other people think about you. Some of the sadness that you're going through now can actually make you a stronger person at the end of it, and can make you and can give you opportunities to use the sadness to potentially help other people out in the world as well. So so chin up.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Matt. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining me today. Please do rate, review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help others find us and helps us to make more episodes. You can find out more about How to Be Sad, the book and the podcast online at Ms. Helen Russell. And take care.